Hello, and welcome to The Dominant Paradigm, an American Gods podcast. We're your hosts,
Dwayne D.
Tosin Anafawakin.
And Andrew Sarsini. We just watched the sixth episode of Starz American Gods' second season titled Donar the Great. We assume you have as well. Total spoilers ahead. Let's dive into the after talk, but before we do, let's catch you up on how to reach us. Here are our online links. You can follow us at Twitter at Gods Podcast, or just hashtag The Dominant Paradigm. Our Facebook page is Podcast American Gods. Write us or send us a voice memo at starsamericangodspod@gmail.com. You can always check us out at on Geeks of Doom, where we've got our posts up. Add us on iTunes, and if you do so, please like us and leave us a review. That's how we get noticed and attention for this show. Let's dive into Donar the Great. So, Dwayne, can you catch us up by giving us a recap of what we saw this week?
I can, but first, a quick technical note. We've had some trouble with iTunes, and so this episode might come in your feed earlier. We're not sure. We're going to try to work it out, but do make sure that you check us out on iTunes, because the series should be up there in its entirety soon. All right, over to the recap. We start literally backstage at a surprisingly integrated 1930s burlesque show. Wednesday sings on stage. After the performance, brown-shirt Nazis arrive, calling themselves the Friends of New Germany. Mr. Nancy is a stage manager behind the curtain. Donar and Columbia plot to leave Wednesday for the West Coast, the two of his acts. In the front of the house, Technical Boy is revealed to be a high roller, and Wednesday sees to it that he's comfortable with booze, smokes, and companionship. Technical Boy declines Wednesday's companionship, and Wednesday gives him a phone so he can take a mysterious call. Donar's act comes on. He's a strong man who performs feats of strength with acrobatic ladies. One of the Friends of New Germany gets Wednesday to introduce him to Donar, where he sells Donar on entering a weightlifting tournament. Columbia recognizes them as Nazis, while Wednesday sees them as sheep ready to worship their pantheon again. The tournament turns out to be a scam. Donar makes it to the finals, only to have the American Nazis ask him to throw the win to the German contender. Donar quits the tournament rather than fake a fall, and then commits to leaving with Columbia for California. Before they could leave, Wednesday and Technical Boy isolate Columbia and sell her on the idea of becoming a symbol of the U.S. war effort. She accepts and becomes Rosie the Riveter. Donar and Wednesday battle, and Donar breaks Wednesday's spear. Donar leaves alone without Columbia, and during the war ends up committing suicide. Back in the now, Mr. World plots. He tells the Keeper of Blackbriar that he's responsible for random attacks. World summons new media, telling her to amp up her power by deepening her worshipper's devotion. She agrees. Shadow and Wednesday head to a Midwestern mall built atop a dwarven center of power to meet Dvalin and his team to fix the runes on his spear. The dwarves send Shadow and Wednesday on a side quest to the other side of the mall to shoplift a studded jacket once worn by Lou Reed. Shadow and Wednesday con the shopkeeper out of the jacket, give it to the dwarves, and the runes on Odwin's spear are restored. The alarms at Blackbriar, the lair of the new gods, go off once this takes place. Mr. World is not frightened, though. It seems as if everything is going to his plan. And that's the recap. Mr. World ends up looking very Sith-like.
All right. Thank you for that recap. Let's get into some of the salient points about this episode. Let's start off with the title here, Donar the Great. Donar the Great is the, as we've discovered in this episode, is the chosen name of Thor Odinson. The episode is centered around him, or at least centered on the flashback between him and Wednesday, and the origin story, basically, about him and what happened to him. In the novel, in the American Gods novel, Donar, who is Thor, essentially, he meets Captain America just as World War II begins to turn against them. The Nazis are suddenly championed by the Norse pantheon.
Yeah, so this episode centers around this particular character, and that the Norse pantheon that represents it is, includes Thor, but also includes, Wednesday, who's Odin, and kind of the rest of their pantheon. And so they ultimately lose.
So in this episode, during the 1930s flashback part of the episode, Wednesday is posing as Al Grimnir. And we know Grimnir is one of the alternate names of Wednesday or Odin. And he is the owner of the Regius Club, and Regius means king. So some very, you know, all the names in this show mean something, and I don't think they're being too guarded or coded about what they mean.
Yeah, I mean, that was a pretty good pull. I love that he called himself Al Grimnir, because, you know, I got to say, Mr. Wednesday looks way more like an Al than a Mr. Yeah. Wednesday, right? Especially in that context. One of the things that Wednesday does I thought was interesting is when they're in the mall, he talks about, hey, this is the mall. This used to be Gomorrah, right, for teenage girls, which means a reference to the Bible. There was the story of Sodom and Gomorrah, two towns that apparently were lascivious and licentious and were full of sin. And so the Hebrew God struck them down with all his might and basically wiped them out. And so the idea that the American mall was Gomorrah is really interesting, especially considering that the mall in this case is now filled with all these geriatric elder people that are anything but you know,
right,
the kind of characters that you would find in Sodom and Gomorrah if you're to believe the stories in the Bible. So that was pretty interesting.
I think one of the banners in the mall referred to the future being 1989. Or something,
right,
like that.
Right. The future's here, 1989, something like that. It was a little nuts.
So one of the things that I found very sort of interesting or poignant is when Donar says, when he's talking to Carolina, they're only men. They're nothing to be afraid of. And it's very interesting because throughout this episode, you know, we see this duality in which the gods need to be worshipped, the gods need the people to be on their side. And looking at this from the past, and we know what the future holds for several of them, right, in which that they are losing their worshippers. And they are maybe close to death, or for some of them, they've passed away. And this is just seems like sort of famous last words where, you know, once your men leave you, then you are actually afraid. So I just found that very interesting kind of way of looking at things.
Yeah, that's a pretty nice circular way of taking a look at it. Without people, there are nothing. At the same time, they're not supposed to be afraid of people.
Yeah, I mean, the curious thing about it is it makes you consider who's really in power, right? Who really wields the hammer?
Yeah, and then if I think about what you're saying in the context of the show that they're working on in the 1930s scene, you know, like people, human beings, are the customer.
Right.
People, human beings, are the ones that are paying the money for it all to work, right? And everyone being employed seems to be gods. I mean, there are even gods that when Wednesday puts the two ladies next to Technical Boy, those are gods too. So they're all some type of god or another, it seems. So it's interesting because at the end of the day, you know, humanity is the client.
Right. Who serves who, the gods or the worshipers?
Exactly. Speaking of worship, in America, there's been this consistent idea in our discourse about the worship of hard work, of, you know, people have these jobs in steel and coal and other things like that. And this series seems to be trying to talk about the difference in America back in 2001 when it came out, and now in 2019 when it's playing, right? And to that fact, we've seen last week when we met the King of the Dwarves. They were in an abandoned factory, right? So Alvis is like, I'm in this abandoned factory. People used to work here. I used to be the foreman. This is all that's left. It's just me in this dark room. And here, we've got this dead mall. So where Wednesday said that this used to be Gomorrah for teenagers, and you can imagine it. Throughout the 70s, 80s, and 90s, kids would run over to malls. If you're 13, 14, 15, living in suburbia, the mall is where you went to hang out, right? you went to all these places, all these little stores, and you bought stuff, you hung out with your friends, you saw movies, whatever. But here, Wednesday's showing us a mall that is in total disrepair, to the point where there's nothing there. Every store you walk into seems empty. They're kind of elder people milling about, almost zombie-like, and it's just not what malls used to be. And this ties into what you often hear in both technology and retail circles, is the retail apocalypse, this idea that people aren't going into stores anymore.
Right. The Amazon effect.
Right. So it's called the Amazon effect, which is interesting considering that Walmart is like 10 to 15 times bigger than Amazon when it comes to retail presence. But that also goes to the fact that people go to Walmart. They don't go to the mall.
Right.
They go to Target. They don't go to the mall. They're not going to sort of these small specialty shops, and they're not going to the big department stores anymore. There's this new model of department store, and it does exist on the Amazon side, the Walmart side, and the Target side. And that's kind of what we're seeing. What we're seeing here is effectively that effect on a physical mall, even though it's built on a dwarven center of power, whatever that means. So I thought that was pretty interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, something else that I thought was pretty interesting is Words by Wednesday. This episode was very musically heavy, as you can probably see from part of the plot. Wednesday did a note in the store when he was looking at Lou Reed's jacket, "Great rock and roll like faith cannot be shaken." So I just found that like very sort of compelling that, you know, rock and roll on its own could be seen as like an American god. It's one of those American pastimes, and similar to faith, it's something that continues to live on.
Rock and roll, jazz, those are uniquely American music forms. Well, I guess the Beatles have a version of rock and roll too. There's a British rock and roll, but there's definitely an American style of rock and roll that I think you're right is central to the culture, and that's really what gods are about, right? Our culture.
Right. I like the idea that rock and roll music sort of transcends. It's like a primary force, like the worship of gods. It's transcendent.
I thought it was interesting that Columbia called herself Manifest Destiny, right? And she said, "I am the West." So a West is a cardinal direction, right? There's no direction more clear than the West than, you know, and the other three friends of the West, right? North, East, and South. But she says she is the West. That's what she sees herself as, this idea of a manifest destiny. It's the doctrine that says it was the destiny of Americans to move across this this continent from the East to the West, and basically in the terms of the time, liberate it from savagery, right? People believed that the existing inhabitants, natives, were a problem, and she is buying into that belief. She is a representative of that belief, and that was really interesting to me.
We have a duty to continue to expand our
westward,
our claim. Yeah, westward.
Mm-hmm. Exactly, and part of that was the geopolitics of the time. Without going west, then suddenly you don't really have claim to the land. So if someone else is there and they're populating it, then international law at the time, international custom said, you don't really have a claim on it. Now, America grabbed a whole bunch of land from Mexico to create California and the West Coast and up as far as the Colorado and the Utah territory. So California was still new in the 30s, right? Hollywood was still new in the 30s. And so the idea that they wanted to go west from Chicago, that was a pretty big deal. What was interesting is that Donar, he worries that there aren't enough worshippers over there. And what does he mean? He means that, you know, he's in Chicago. Chicago's got a bunch of Hessians, which are a type of German. It's got a whole bunch of, you know, the Midwest has a whole bunch of Norse mythological followers, people who are from Sweden and Norway and so on. And he's like, "Where are these people in the West? I don't know if I'm going to be okay." And she's saying, "It doesn't matter. I've got so much like favor and clout that you can ride on my coattails," which is a pretty wild assumption for the time, right? This idea that like this big, strong man is going to be able to live out there because he's got the power of this woman behind him. So I thought that was pretty interesting. That stuck out to me.
Yeah. Speaking of Columbia, In this episode, she performs a Western number that thematically is essentially about freedom and liberty. Don't Fence Me In. That's the number, that's the musical number that she performs, which is in contrast in this episode to what the Friends of New Germany are proposing for Donar, which is basically for him to be their puppet.
Right, right. It also goes into this idea that the Don't Fence Me In is kind of tied to what Grimnir or Wednesday or Odin wants, right? So Wednesday's like, you guys are under contract. You guys are working for me.
Right.
And right. You're locked into me. And that's the thing that I think is really interesting, because she's like, don't fence me in. At the same time, she's plotting to escape. She's kind of saying outwardly to everybody, hey, don't fence, like, you know, I'm not going to be fenced in by Wednesday. And then I'm going to plan on the backside to run away with his son. Mm-hmm.
So something that I found kind of comical is the fact that Carl, who is the cashier at the store, mm-hmm. he gets conned, right? The store gets conned, but Carl.
The con was pretty cool. We should talk about the con.
Yeah, the con was well thought out, and finally we actually show something that has occurred in the books, because I think this is the first con that is both Wednesday and Shadow. Mm-hmm. But Carl gives the money back. However, he keeps the tip in his pocket. So although he believes that the money is fake, he still has that belief that this gift from the gods or God is something that he should treasure, and that's something that he can keep and potentially will still try to spend. So kind of interesting. Interesting little small note to think about.
It's almost like they gave him an incentive to not really pursue them, right?
Right.
By giving him the tip. Now, the thing is, yes, is the cash fake? So the cash was clearly not fake, right?
Right.
That's the clever part. The idea is you go in, you get the good that you want, you hand over the cash, but you find a reason to get your cash back, so you end up with your cash and with the good that you want. Yeah. Now, it occurs to me that if they wanted to, they could have borrowed the jacket, so to speak, and brought it back, right? No harm, no foul. But these guys are grifters. They want to take everything they can get. And I thought that was pretty interesting.
Right. Two things about this I wanted to mention is that we did see... This is the first con that we've seen Shadow and Wednesday collaborating in since season one, when we saw them do that bank job. Where
Shadow calls up on the phone and says, hey, I'm just checking your security, whatever.
Right.
And Wednesday goes out and he takes all the deposits. So that was in Totosa's point, you know, that was the two of them, but they weren't really together. In this case, they had to be together at the same time, pretending not to know one another, pretending to be adversarial in order to get their hands on this thing. And what was really interesting to me is, I mean, they're actors, so like, yes, they did well. But in the books, this happens over and over and over again as they move through the country and they need funds.
Right, right. This particular con, by the way, this I've seen this before in the movie Midnight Run with Robert De Niro and I can't remember who the other guy was. But they pulled off this con in one of their stops.
I wonder if it's in Chicken Run.
I can't vouch for that. Or any other runs, for that matter. So Wednesday says to Technical Boy in this episode, he says, we are the ancient ones. You know, the ones that paved the way so you kids could do your thing. He's reminding Technical Boy in this episode that the only reason that they are able to thrive is because the ancient ones laid the path for them.
Right, right. And you know what's really cool about that? He gives this little speech about, you know, the fact that, yeah, you're hot now. What's going to happen when there's a new technology for communicating? Right. And
Technical
Boy can't. Yeah, it's foreshadowing, but it's also post-shadowing, because we know that Technical Boy is rendered obsolete by Mr. World, right? What's really interesting...
By new media.
New Media and Mr. World were going to, I mean, Technical Boy was in the CEO's office, if you remember, and Mr. World shows up, and Mr. World says that what you just said to the CEO shows me how obsolete you are. And then somehow magically Technical Boy ends up in his own VR thing, right? He's retired or whatever. But what's interesting to me is during the scene with Wednesday in this episode, during the flashback, Technical Boy is so oblivious to the idea that something beyond the telephone could even occur. Yep. Yep. As I watched the whole thing on my computer streaming video at like, you know, multiple megabits a second. And he even goes as far as to say copper backlight. Backlight's the type of plastic that telephones were made out of.
Right.
This idea that that he can't see beyond this, and he's the technical one. He should be on the edge of technology. He should be the guy with the Zach Morris cell phone. You know what I mean? Like he should be that dude. But it goes to like I think establishing his character even better by saying that he was too foolish to even see the future.
I think it's the fate of those that are on the cutting edge of technology to not be able to see, to not be able to imagine technology beyond that.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's true for some people, but as three people who love technology right now, I feel like we're constantly imagining where we want the technology to be.
But I'm speaking in the context of this show with Technical Boy. And I would say even new media probably can't imagine a future that is more cutting edge than new media.
Right. I get that. Especially because it seems as if she's, even when Mr. World says deepen your devotion, right?
Yeah.
She just kind of like piles on more of the same. She's like, I had one smiley face. Now I have three smiley faces. Mm-hmm, isn't that great? And Mr. World, he doesn't quite sigh, but he doesn't look impressed. Right. So that's definitely something really interesting. Speaking of looking at oneself, this is a great scene after the con where Shadow and Wednesday are planning, okay, we'll wait here till the mall closes, then we'll go to the elves and whatever. And they're in this room in some department store that's been abandoned, and in it are just a whole bunch of mannequins, right? A whole bunch of effectively puppets.
Right.
And they've used people as puppets is what they do. But as they sit down on this bench and Shadow does what Wednesday calls an interrogation against him, there's two mirrors. And while we see the men talking, we see reflections of them in the two mirrors. And the moment in which they're talking was a reflective one where Shadow's like, what do you see in me that reminds me of your son? So Wednesday has to reflect as he's physically being reflected, and I thought that was pretty cool.
Hmm. Didn't put that together.
Yeah, I didn't catch that either. That's a very astute observation.
Hashtag liberal arts. Tosin, what do you got about Dvalin?
Yeah, so Dvalin, he's a very interesting dwarf because he needs an American icon to imbue icons on the weapon of an American god. So it's a sort of like transformation of power, or at least this movement, this flow of power, as we kind of talked about how rock and roll is as much a god as the American gods, and we're moving some of that power into Wednesday's weapon. So pretty good.
Yeah, it's very like literal, but at the same time it's pretty abstract, right? So that was pretty interesting. Speaking of things that the runes are things that have to be said and so on. I thought that one thing that was said that was pretty funny was Donar, when he met the friend of Germany guy, the Nazi. Odin's like, hey, this is Manfred. He's one of the friends of Germany, and he's like, oh, I got a deal for you. It's gonna be so awesome. Do this. And he goes, okay, fiend of Germany. Which to me was a beautiful way for the show to say, look, we've got Nazis in uniform. Let's face it. Hollywood loves to put a guy in a Nazi uniform, right? He just does. At the same time, we're going to just throw in this subversive line that both foreshadows what happens. You know, Nazis do become the fiends of Germany. They hurt Germany very badly. But it also speaks to this person's character as a fiend. And later on, it foreshadows because he is a fiend. He wants Donar to take a dive, right?
Yeah.
And Donar, he knows that, you know, no one is stronger than him in the U.S., right? To the point where the hammer is being dragged and he easily lifts it up. This is not a problem for him. But at the same time, this Manfred guy, he's a fiend, you know?
Indeed, he is. Speaking of the friends of Germany, Wednesday does a great job reminding the audience in this episode that the Nazis perverted the swastika, and it's meant other things to other people for long before the Nazis appropriated it.
That's a really good point, especially because I never knew until high school.
Yeah.
That the, you know, what we call the swastika has many other names. It's used in Sanskrit. It was used in Buddhism. It was used in multiple different religions as a symbol of all sorts of things, from peace, other things. But in our current culture, it means the opposite of peace, right? It means destroying certain types of people. It means intolerance.
Right.
And when Wednesday casually says, "Why are you wearing?" and he uses words that are so quick. Like, I get what he's saying, but I couldn't just kind of, I couldn't like quickly like
other names for the swastika throughout history.
Right. Exactly. He uses all these names and he lays them out. It's at least four separate names without using the word swastika, just to kind of, again, just kind of like fiend of Germany, just batter into your head that like these people are, they're not only like, problematic, they're also like, incompetent kind of, right? Like, you're going to use this symbol. You don't even know what it means, because the guy's like, "Oh, it's a symbol of our movement," or whatever. I thought that was pretty powerful, especially when it was backed up by Thor, who does a callback later, like, "Why is he wearing this symbol?"
Yeah.
And then basically Wednesday uses that knowledge, this idea that they don't even know what they're talking about, to realize that they're sheep and that they'll give them worship. They'll worship the Norse pantheon, and that they're usable because the people don't even know their symbols. So that was pretty interesting.
Yeah, the final thing that that we'll close out here in terms of salient points is this quote, "Sometimes you remind me of my son." That's what Wednesday told to Shadow, and Donar is Grimnir's son, as we learned throughout this episode. It's very interesting that he said this, especially as you noted, during the scene with the mirrors and the reflection. I'm very I do have a question on that, and maybe we'll share that in our next section.
Yeah. One thing about saying "sometimes you remind me of my son" also is that for anyone who's ever read the books, that's like ding ding ding, that's so weird, why would he say that?
Yeah.
You know, it's a big red flag. Highlight of strangeness.
Yes. Right. It's a big highlight, and it's something that develops as a sort of major plot point in the story, but it only in the books, but only sort of it's a thing that appears and you kind of connect the pieces at a point without saying too much. But it's very odd that they just were like, "Oh, let's toss this out here. You know, let's toss this out."
I will say that I always wondered what happened to Thor in the book. I didn't feel like there was a discussion about Donar, Thor, and the books, and that maybe that was just an issue with the editor saying, "Hey, this book can't be 700 pages long," because it sounds like that's exactly what Neil Gaiman kind of wanted. My initial thought, because you've got like people like Loki, Lysmith, remember in the first episode of the first season, and you're like, okay, so you got some gods from the Norse pantheon here, but you don't have some of the big ones, right? You don't have Thor. You don't have, we don't see any real Valkyries. We don't see anything like that. So where are these other gods? And, you know, the scope of the book has to be smaller. So I'm glad that they could get into this a little bit. And that's kind of where I'm at. Tosin, you had some questions, huh?
I did. And so the first question is, you know, now that we heard that from Wednesday, what are the characteristics that Thor and Shadow share?
Yeah, no idea except for that they're both tall and strong. Shadow seems a bit sharper than Thor does. I mean, the Thor performance felt a little bit like he was imitating the Hemsworth guy in the Marvel movies.
And that Wednesday has taken a keen interest in both Thor and Shadow.
To make money with, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. He's using both of them. Question is, will it result in the same sort of pain and suffering? Mm-hmm. Will it result in the same end for Thor and Shadow? Hard to say.
Did you have another question, Tosin?
Yeah, and I don't know if this was just me picking on something that seemed a little esoteric, but there's this image of a girl who seems pretty sad or distraught, and is shown in sort of repeated shots in the Dead Mall sort of intro.
Mm-hmm.
Is there any importance to that? Most of the other characters that they were just showing were only seen once. It's unclear.
Yeah, I don't know. I didn't put anything together, really, I gotta say.
It may have meant to reinforce the idea of how tragically sad these Dead Malls are when they once were Gamora to teenagers.
Yeah, it's true. Now it's a place of sadness as opposed to a place of like glee, happiness, carefreeness, and disregard for like the proper way of doing things. Now you've got these moribund people. It's almost like it was destroyed, like Gamora.
All right, now let's move into our big picture segment. Now we've covered the salient visual points of the episode and some questions that we have. This big picture section, this is where we discuss how the events of this particular episode impact what we know about the overarching story arc. In this episode, we learned that Wednesday says there are certain deaths our kind cannot come back from. And it is left for a little bit of a mystery until the very end of the episode when we discover that suicide, in this particular case, the suicide of Donar, is the only death, besides the lack of worshippers, that the ancient gods cannot come back from.
Yeah, it's a pretty interesting thing, because you think of, you know, Argus kept on dying, right? Just sort of dying almost as if he meant to die. So he'd read a book and get some knowledge and he'd die and then he'd show up somewhere else, right? That seemed to be a special power to him. Whereas if you take your own life as a god, you don't come back. That to me is interesting. I guess it's because if you're at that point, then you've given up all hope. You don't believe in yourself. And without believing in yourself, how can you exist if you're a god? That's the only kind of like headcanon logic that I could put together for that.
Let's talk about some of the deities that we met in this episode. Dwayne, do you want to touch upon some of those?
Yeah, sure. So you've got Donar. He's played by Derek Theller. And Donar is another name for Thor, Odin's son. And Thor is the son of Odin and the protector of Asgard. So I think the performance is pretty powerful, I got to say. I believed that he was the son of Odin, and the distant son of Odin. That is to say, they were not close, right? Mm. But in the beginning, they're having a little conversation, him and Columbia, and he's like, I have a contract with him. So it's almost as if, rather than having raised him from a boy, Thor was put there basically by the people who believe in Thor, and Odin was put there by the people who believe in Odin, and there wasn't that kind of like nurturing growing upness that we expect from father and son. So it was interesting. That's how the distance played with me. Columbia is played by Laura Bell Bundy, and I gotta say, this performance, I'd love to hear what you guys thought, but I bought it.
Yeah, really totally good.
Yeah,
It reminded me a little bit of Kristen Chenoweth as Easter.
Right.
Like, it's only one episode, an episode or two, but it really, like, really puts a cap, a shining star on the entire series as something that, you know, I don't know that I was looking forward to, but I was surprised and delighted.
I think, like Kristen Chenoweth, Laura Bell Bundy is a veteran of the musical stage.
Yes, so that's obvious. That's clearly that's very helpful, especially when it comes to me, who loves that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I think she captured, whereas Kristen Chenoweth was, you know, Southern Belle kind of Kentucky lady. She captured that. It's not the femme fatale from that era, the 40s. It's the other type of woman that, you know, show busy, happy, carefree, mm-hmm. able to, you know, love somebody kind of gal, you know, G-A-L. Her mannerisms, her voice, she really picked it up and pushed it. And she managed to stay, you know, playful, even through her burlesque scene, which, you know, burlesque is a very playful art. Right. But I was pretty impressed by it, and she was so determined about what she wanted. I was definitely thrown off by her choice to sort of follow Technical Boy and become Rosie the Riveter. That threw me off a little bit, only because it seemed as if it wasn't the thing she wanted to do. But when presented with the idea, it was straightforward, easy worship, so to say, if worship is a currency.
Yes, but I will say that it also came after Wednesday told her erroneously that Dinar had already gone off with the Germans.
Right, so Wednesday, master manipulator there. I think Ian McShane felt a little bit more like the Ian McShane I knew from Deadwood mm-hmm. than we've seen in the second season of American Gods, and I thought that was pretty great. And it's so funny when these things happen, because these things happen in TV shows and movies all the time. The guy in the middle tells person A the one thing, tells person B another thing, and tragedy ensues. What's really right. interesting is how they didn't wait to communicate with one another. They just took this guy they don't like yeah. at their word,
It's a total Romeo and Juliet moment.
Exactly. Even when I'm watching Romeo and Juliet from 1996 with Claire Danes, I'm like, you can't send an email?
Right.
So moving on, we've got DeValon. He was played by Jeremy Raymond. I've been a fan of Raymond for a while. He's in a few other science fiction, fantasy kind of stuff. He's a clever actor. I don't think we really got a ton of him in this episode, simply because he was kind of playing this this character that was maybe on the spectrum, or maybe a little touched, a special needs character. But once he got access to that jacket, he kind of like lit up, and you know, you believe that he was involved in what he was saying. Finally, there was a small mention of Asamba, an African goddess of the moon, and that was one of the ladies that was asked to sit next to Technical Boy. So that was interesting to me. Also, what was interesting to me was Mr. Nancy moving through accents. So he went
code
from
switching. Code switching.
That's exactly what I was going to say. He's code switching. He goes from his sort of like backstage manager voice that's super Broadway, super of the time, and we completely recognize that voice, to his like, I'm an angry African god voice. and I thought that was really interesting. So that's what's going on with the deities this episode. Andy, what are you thinking of the episode? You have some overall thoughts, right?
I think overall, this episode was definitely more engaging than the last couple that we saw, episodes 4 and 5 of the second season. And this, to me, was very reminiscent of the vibe of season 1.
Yeah.
But I'm still unclear where this season is heading overall, other than this grander arc of these two sides continuously gearing up towards war. Like, I don't know. I don't see. All I see is this overarching plot of these two sides gearing up for war, and everything else to me still feels like padding, like getting to point B, getting to the part where they go to war. And I'm fairly certain that they will not go to war this season, because there's still a whole bunch of stuff from the book that we need to cover before we get to that war, which is definitively in the climax of this narrative.
Right. So I agree with you there. I do feel as if, so first off, this episode really does take it away from episodes 4 and 5. Now, it feels to me like the season, as you're talking about it, it feels a little bit like season 5 of Game of Thrones, right? Shout out to Game of Thrones, which kicked off again tonight for season 8. But season 5 of Game of Thrones, if you watch it by itself, you're like, okay, I see some things happening with Sansa. I see some things happening with Arya. But I don't really see the whole vying for the Iron Throne really moving right now. I'm not seeing any plot points being hit, right? But then when you get to season 6, everything that the people were waiting for happens, right? Brienne meets up with Sansa. Sansa and Jon get back together. Arya makes her way back home. Daenerys gets her. All that shit happens, right? So my point is that on some level, I almost feel like episodes 4 and 5 helped lead to the episode 6, which is nice. But I think that season 2 is that way of building up the base, building up the characters, so that when we get to season 3, we don't see them dealing out death and destruction sort of randomly. We see them basically doing what they do, but we understand the context of why they're doing it, how they're doing it, what's motivating them to do it. And I think that's my hope anyway for what's happening.
I really hope so too. I'm getting really pretty tired of this fetch quest that everyone is sending Wednesday on in order to accomplish.
That Wednesday's sending everybody else on.
Yeah. I mean, basically the idea is to fix his spear, his war spear. And it's not just a straightforward thing. You got to go do this. You got to go find this guy, but this guy can't do it. So you got to find the dwarves, and then dwarves
won't do
it. It's a
little bit like playing a game of Quake or some other like mystery game where you have to kind of run around and push this button and then go to this other place, go to the supply depot and push that button. And
right.
And
but I think you mean Myst.
So Myst is the mystery one, but even in Quake 2, you have to run around the Strahd home world trying to disable shit so they can't destroy Earth.
Right. But the point is that it all feels very convoluted. Like it's like they're just sort of padding out the season. And,
but Andy, trees don't grow overnight.
They do in this world when you piss on them.
It's still a small. It's still small. It still needs to grow.
It's a shrub. That's true.
It's a shrubbery.
I will say that we've talked a little bit about the way the episodes have been edited. Mm-hmm. And in episode 4, we have this whole thing with the CEO. Episode 5 has its thing. Episode 6 has this one flashback that lasts throughout the whole entire episode, right, as the B plot. And I do think that worked for me better than sort of the 8-minute mini movie at the beginning of episode 4 with the CEO, or the other thing they did in episode 5 where they had their own kind of like separate thing. Now, I get why they do that, and I think it's interesting. Each director is going to take their own tack with it. But I really felt that this whole thing where they had the A plot and the B plot, and the B plot was the flashback, which explains why the spear is broken in the first place. For me, that was a beautiful payoff, right? Mm-hmm. It gave us a little bit of action, which I think American Gods needs sometimes. It also showed us that Wednesday isn't as all-powerful as you would think when Thor's hammer is able to break his spear. So at the end of the day, this whole flashback thing worked. The filters worked. The fact that they were able to bring in other gods that we know, like Mr. Nancy inside of it, worked. So I was pretty impressed. I thought that really, I got juiced. I got jazzed up. I got excited about American Gods in a way I haven't been for a couple weeks.
I really actually did enjoy this episode a lot more than the others. Now, keep in mind, this is a much lighter episode with a much lighter palette and sort
no
of profile.
Ruby Goodchild.
Yeah, and not as like dark and as and even just in sort of the overall color usage. So, yeah, I think this was a good step in the right direction. So another thing that I found interesting here is there's this quote that was said: "Sheep in search of a shepherd, like he is a god in search of worshipers." Mm-hmm. We talked about this already in Salient Points, but that's really sort of that duality, right, of, you know, God and man and sort of what each serves and who worships who.
The social ecosystem, so to speak.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. What I thought was interesting in this episode is that we saw Wednesday as an ancient one, coordinating these, brokering these deals with Technical Boy, who represents
new god, yeah.
the new god, which to me implies that at one time the ancient ones were allies to the new gods. But
what happened?
But since then, yeah, in the current in our present day state, we know that there's a rift between the old gods and the new gods. So you have to wonder what happened that to cause that rift where there's no more allying between these two. Was this instigated maybe by the presence of Mr. World?
Yeah, I like that. If you look at America itself, right, like politically, there's this place where poli-sci people look at like 1994 as the time when the Democrats and Republicans stopped working together as they used to, and they kind of became the beginning of, you know, the polarization that people say that they experience today really began to happen. And it almost seems as if this whole thing where Wednesday is working with what we know will be his enemy later, is in that kind of pre-time when everybody said, oh, okay, yeah, we want this crime bill, we want this thing, and everyone kind of got along. And then we don't know what happened to separate them. But I kind of get this feeling of camaraderie, like, hey, little guy, I'm going to tell you that we were here before you were here, and that matters. And it's like, okay, we can help each other out. I got a deal for you, that kind of thing. It's also interesting because Mr. World had to say to the guy over at Black Briar that the new gods have to build on the old, which Wednesday reiterates here, right? So that was interesting to me. So Mr. World and Wednesday are coming from the same perspective, but somehow they have radically different ideas of who should hold power. So there's been a falling out, and that falling out is pretty significant. The last thing I want to say here in the big picture is there's a bit of an Anansi redux here. I think we might have been looking at Anansi maybe not in the most appropriate way over the last few episodes. So over the last few episodes, we'll have him tell some story. And we've been talking about how we like to see stories shown rather than being told, right? You guys remember us talking about that? The thing is, as I look back to what Anansi is supposed to be, he is a storyteller. And whether he's telling the story that is the founding myth of like Zoroastrianism, I'm sorry if I pronounced that incorrectly, or he's talking about other things, at the end of the day, he's a parable teller. He's a person who's focused on parables. And that's something that we find brought back in the Bible and Jesus, which also Jesus ties to that whole sheep thing Tosin was talking about. But at the end of the day, I think that one of the reasons why he's being used in the way he is being used is because he's supposed to be this kind of avuncular storytelling person that helps put you on the right path. And we see it in the episode when he uses that story of Zoroaster to get Thor to abandon this weightlifting tournament altogether, you know, basically don't play their game because they're going to use you in ways that you don't want to be used, and you've got more honor than that. And I thought that was interesting because it seemed to be the right move for Thor at the time, where Thor seems to make Donar seems to make a mistake is when he finds himself splitting off from Wednesday. Wednesday is a survivor. And what we've been able to see thus far is that Wednesday is very good at making sure the people who support him end up with some level of support, even if it's completely meager, right? So all these old gods are just barely hanging on, but you know it's because Wednesday's been working for him, right? So Anansi, that's what I'm seeing as Anansi. That said, Andy, you had something to say about, despite Anansi's role, how Orlando Jones is playing him?
Yeah, so we're shifting into performances here, and I have to say that Orlando Jones, when he first debuted his performance as Anansi, I thought that it was one of the most powerful, compelling performances, single scenes of any TV that I'd seen that year, perhaps. But I feel like at this point, with all the, you know, frequent code switching and the amping it up to 11, that his performance is dangerously drifting into broad self-parody. I don't know if you guys are feeling the same thing.
You don't like the code switching?
You know, I like it when it's narratively appropriate, but he seems to be arbitrarily doing it just randomly.
I when I was listening to him walking through the backstage,
yeah,
using it, I was a little bit reminded of how my mom would code switch when she would, you know, she's talking to a wider audience at a party and then like talking to me in like a West Indian accent because I was doing something incorrect. So I kind of felt that a little bit. Mm-hmm, I gotta say, mm-hmm. It worked for me, but I understand that that's not gonna work for everybody.
Yeah. Any significant changes from the book that we noticed this week?
Finally getting to the meat of what happened to Thor Odinson, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. That was a pretty big deal. I also thought it was pretty, I was happy to meet Columbia. I do want to know what happened to Rosie the Riveter. She falls into obscurity, right? I know that there was a woman who claimed that she was the inspiration for Rosie the Riveter here in real life. But yeah, the whole Rosie the Riveter thing was new. The whole club thing was new. We don't really understand what Wednesday's been doing for the longest time when we first meet him in the airport with Shadow. So yeah, all that stuff was new. But again, I think this season is about building out those characters. We don't see the Djinn. We don't see Laura and Sweeney. And frankly, I think that made the episode better.
Yeah, we allowed Wednesday to, you know, kind of take the show here, to run the gamut, and I think that was well worth it here. To be honest, a lot of this episode is sort of novel, right? Mm-hmm. A lot of it is something
novel in that it's not in the novel.
Yeah, novel, it's not in the novel, exactly.
Well, let's wrap this episode up by bringing up some ephemera. This is like extra textual stuff that is not necessarily specifically related to or important to the episode itself, but connected to it in one way or another. And Dwayne, you have a very relevant historical note to in relation to the Friends of New Germany that we saw in this episode.
Yeah, so there's this wonderful documentary called A Night at the Garden, it's a 2017 short documentary film about a 1939 Nazi rally by the Friends of Germany, and it filled Madison Square Garden back in 1939, right? It's directed by Marshall Curry. It's only 7 minutes long, but it's an Oscar-nominated documentary in the short form. So it's gotten wide recognition for what it is. The Friends of Germany are a pseudonym for the German-American Bund, which is worth looking into if anyone's listening to this is interested. They're an pro-white Christian anti-Semitic group that was trying to get the U.S. in politically on the side of Nazi Germany. They're like, oh, there's so many things you have in common, which is really, really interesting to me. But if you have a moment, take a look at the documentary. It gives you context into why these people are walking around Chicago or any other major city in America wearing swastikas, wearing brown shirts, in normal society, and interacting with people without the kind of disdain that I think most of us would imagine we associated with the Nazis in the U.S. back in the 30s and 40s, right? So it's very, very interesting documentary, and it doesn't take very long to watch, and I think it gives some pretty good context into why those people walk into the room and they're not like being like yelled at or booed or anything, right? Because that kind of throws you off.
Where is this available again? Or is it available?
It's available on Vimeo.
Vimeo.
And I'll put the link in the super post that we put out at the end of every episode.
Cool. All right. As I mentioned before, the counterfeit money scam that we saw in this episode, I feel is definitely in some way or shape or form a reference to seeing it in the movie Midnight Run, because they did it exactly like that in that movie. And we should talk about some of the musical references in this episode. Tosin, do you want to mention a couple of them?
Yeah, no, I mean, there was a lot of music that was used here. So there was Brother, Can You Spare Me a Dime? Don't Fence Me In. Lou Reed's Vicious and Kill Your Son.
This was a very musical episode this week.
Yeah.
So. Yeah. It I wish they did it more, to be honest. There's a lot you can do with American music and puns on things that gods do in a show like American Gods. So I kind of really wish they did it more. I mean, Westworld does it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, it may be a budgetary thing, but it's nice to hear it every once in a while. It's nice to get great, like, fully produced musical numbers like the Don't Fence Me In thing.
Sure. The good news about the music they use is that, Brother, Can You Spare a Dime? That's like public domain music, right? So yeah. That's let's just see more of that, guys.
All right. That is going to do it for this week's episode of The Dominant Paradigm, with the exception of going around the table. I'll start with you, Dwayne. Where can people find your work on the internet when you're not here co-hosting The Dominant Paradigm?
You can find me on Twitter, twitter.com/DwayneD. You can also find me on Geeks of Doom, and you can check me out when I do stuff with these other two guys. What about you, Tozen?
You can find me at twitter.com/toast4321. You can also find me on geeksofdoom.com. What about yourself, Andy?
You can find me at mrbabyman.com, which is my social media handle, and or just do a Google search for Mr. Babyman or Andrew Sorsini. You'll find everything that I'm checking out over the week. You can find me with these two guys on the Geeks of Doom podcast network on the Drill Down, which is our weekly tech show. When HBO's Westworld comes back around, you can find us hosting recapping Westworld on Violent Delights. And outside of that, just check us out here on the Geeks of Doom podcast network on Geeks of Doom. And join us next week on The Dominant Paradigm, where we talk about the next episode of American Gods titled Treasure of the Sun. So until then, we'll see you guys next week.
Bye, guys.